Okay, this time last year we had a sermon series called something like, well, the sort of rough heading we used all the time was Living the Light of the Future. We thought about what God would tell us will happen in the future and how that affects now. It sort of reflects back into now. Because we shape life now depending on certain things that we expect. You know, I mean, just on the kind of ordinary level, that's true. Some people here are planning on getting married. Some are thinking about moving house, some are hoping for a change of job or a promotion, some are looking forward to a holiday, or whatever it is, there's something in the future. And if you know those things are coming in the future, they impinge back on the now, the present. They affect how you live, how you think, what you expect, your hopes, what you give yourself to. Now, obviously, some things do that more than others. Some things are big in the future, dominant, and all of life is shaped by it. Other things are relatively small, and so on. Well, nothing is bigger than what God says about the future, and we're returning to that very theme in our passage, thinking about how we live, waiting for or in the light of the judgment that God speaks about coming. We left Jesus last week having been asked some challenging questions, if you were here, and having asked a few back himself. And he finished specifically talking to his disciples in the temple. Chapter 21, verse 1, they're in the temple. Jesus makes some comments about what's going on there. And so then in verse 5, some of his disciples are commenting on how the temple is adorned with beautiful stones and with gifts dedicated to God and so on. But Jesus seems to take a bit of a downer to this. Verse 6, as for what you see here, the time will come when not one stone will be left on another. Every one of them will be thrown down. Let me show you a picture from the paper this week. Rich Owen sent me this. I'm not sure if you can see that very well. The guy at the back is an old gentleman who spent 30 years building a model of the temple in his spare time, I think, in a big shed in the back of his house. If we go to the next slide, you'll see a bit more of a close-up. Pretty impressive structure. Absolutely enormous. Pretty impressive structure. So these guys were kind of going, Jesus, isn't it an amazing building? Isn't our temple incredible? And Jesus says, it's all going to go. It's going to be absolutely trashed. But it wasn't only a very impressive building, it was a hugely symbolic building. We just don't have an equivalent. But I mean, think of, as an attempt to illustrate it, think of the Houses of Parliament, I don't know, Trafalgar Square, Buckingham Palace, all kind of rolled into one. And someone saying, it's all going to be destroyed. See, the temple was the very centre of life for Israel. This was where kind of God lived among them, where sort of defined them as a people. And Jesus is saying, not one stone on another. This is the end of life as a nation, as God's people. And of course, when you talk about destroying a temple like this, there's a history to this. This has happened once before. God's people in the Old Testament, we read, had rejected him, turned against him, not listened to his warnings, and eventually God had said, well, I'm leaving then. And he'd handed his people over to other nations. God said, I'm going to punish you. In practice, that meant the nation's overrun, the temple is destroyed, and the people are taken into exile. Well, Jesus is saying the same sort of thing is going to happen again. He's not just talking about the end of a building. He is saying judgment will come on this nation. God's going to bring punishment on people. Well, we saw this just a couple of weeks ago. Just turn back to chapter 19, just back over one page, chapter 19, verse 41. Jesus comes to Jerusalem, he weeps, He says, only if you'd known what would bring peace and so on. But verse 43, the days will come on you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground. You and the children within your walls, they will not leave one stone on another. Why not? Because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. God sends his son, Jesus, to his people, but they don't recognize him. In fact, they reject him. We saw this a couple of weeks ago in chapter 20 as well, in the parable of the tenants. And God will bring punishment on his people for that rejection. That is what Jesus is talking about. That's why this destruction of the temple is so significant. Now notice what the disciples then ask. Verse 7, back in chapter 21. Teacher, when will these things happen? And what will be the sign that they're about to take place? So, you know, what's the timing? What are the telltale signs? Now, this is where I need to begin to tell you about some of the complexity of this passage. Okay, as Jesus goes on, he clearly talks about the destruction of Jerusalem, which happens in 70 AD. That's what he's talking about back in chapter 19, with the embankments and being, you know, encircled and so on. That's what he goes on to speak about, say, in verse 20 of our passage, just over the page. When you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies. Well, that's what happened in 70 AD. The Romans rolled in. And they did surround Jerusalem and laid siege to it, and so on. And so this, what's usually called the fall of Jerusalem, this wasn't just some random battle that happened to take place in the middle of the first century. This was God's judgment on his people for their rejection of Jesus. This was the end of Israel as a country, the end of the temple system. And this passage, I believe, is about that moment. But to make things more complicated, Jesus also talks in terms of final judgment. Just look on to verse 25, for example, over the page. There'll be signs in the sun and moon and stars on the earth. Nations will be in anguish and so on. Verse 27, at that time they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Well, it sounds like he's talking about what's usually called Jesus' second coming. Jesus spoke of this many times, that he would return, not this time to suffer and die, but to rule, and that he would judge. Now, the reason there's great debate is some people say this entire passage is all about that future final judgment. It's all about that. And so even the stuff about Jerusalem being kind of surrounded and all that sort of business, that's yet to happen. Okay, I don't understand that view at all. Well, actually, I do understand it, but I don't believe it. Okay, some people say all of this is about 70 AD. So some say all final judgment. Some say it's all 70 AD. And you might think, well, what about that Son of Man coming on the clouds business? Well, there are actually some quite good reasons why you might think that is about 70 AD, and I'm going to come to that later on. I have to tell you, I've changed my mind at least twice this week, I think. Okay? And I'm going to try and explain some of the details as to how that could be the case on the way through, but I'm not going to do it all because we just get really bogged down and I wouldn't say anything helpful. Okay, so that's the tension of this morning for us. Okay? I will pause for some questions at some point. So if you're thinking, what about this verse? You'll have your chance. There's a really key thing to see, though, which means, in a sense, it doesn't matter so much which position you take, and that is this. The destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD is a picture of final judgment. It's like a little model version of what will happen with the whole world. Now, God brings judgment on his people because of their rejection of Jesus. God says he will do that globally, not just locally, one day. And that is why I think Jesus moves from one to the other with barely a break. And that's why, even if he is speaking about 70 AD the whole time, I think he's talking about both, but even if he is speaking about 70 the whole time, there are still applications to us, because one is a picture of the final judgment that we live in the light of. Does that little bit just make sense? Right. What does Jesus say about living in the light of judgment? I'm going to do some of the early stuff. I'll come back to some of the how it works business, and you can ask some questions then. So first of all, Jesus says, don't be taken in. Verse 8, watch out that you are not deceived. For many will come in my name, claiming I am he, and the time is near. Do not follow them. Goes on to talk about wars and uprisings, nations rising against nation, earthquakes, famines, and so on. And the point is, there are going to be a lot of false claims about the end. People saying, I'm the Messiah and it's just around the corner. There'll be some climactic world events, wars, earthquakes, famines. They might look like it's the end of the world. It's all going so pear-shaped. But don't be deceived. Now, that sort of warning was true in the first century. It's true in the 21st century. There are still occasional claims from people that they are actually the Messiah. Fortunately, today we tend to write that sort of claim off straight away. They would need a bit more warning about that in the first century. But there are certainly lots of claims of people reading world events and saying at the end of verse 8, the time is near. We know it's about to happen. This war means da 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 da. I remember a friend in Cambridge who was a lovely guy, utterly convinced about this. He was thought Jesus was coming back any time. It's the last days, Graham. Couple of years tops. Gave me a book about it, you know. It was 10 years ago. Two things that virtually all predictions about Jesus' return have got in common. What are they? Two things that all the predictions of when Jesus is coming back and the time is near, it'll be just next week, just next year. Lots of predictions made like that throughout history. Two things in common. They're all wrong. No one's got it right yet. Obvious point, but warning. I mean, no one's got it right yet. You know? Second thing, slightly more subtle. They don't know their Bible. They're all predictions that he'll come very soon. Very rare for someone to predict it would be 1,000 years' time, because that's boring. Next year is really interesting, you know? So they all predict it very quickly, very soon. They've all been wrong. Jesus says, don't be deceived. Now that raises all sorts of issues about can we know anything? And later on, Jesus will talk about actually looking at the fig tree and signs of things about to happen. I've kind of dissed this, and I'm aware there are some complexities to the argument. You can ask some questions if you want to, but I think he's saying don't take any of that stuff seriously. Secondly, be ready to stand up for Jesus. Verse 12. Before all this, they will lay hands on you and persecute you. They'll deliver you to synagogues and prisons, and you'll be brought before kings and governors, all on account of my name. You'll get it in the neck and be put on trial and stuff because you're a Christian. Verse 14. Make up your mind not to worry beforehand how you'll defend yourself. I'll give you words and wisdom and so on. You'll be betrayed even by parents and brothers and sisters and so on. They'll put some of you to death. Now, all we have to do is read the book of Acts, and in fact some of the book of Revelation, to read the fulfillment of exactly these words. The apostles and their members of the early church were indeed handed over to synagogues, stood before kings. They were given wisdom so that they made a good defense. And it is all to bear testimony to Jesus. Verse 13, and so you will bear testimony to me. You will stand up for me and proclaim the good news of the gospel and the truth of who I am. But as you do that, you may get it in the neck. There may be betrayal from a family member. Some of you will die. You've got to be ready to stand up for me in this. This isn't going to be easy. Jesus isn't talking about a walk in the park here. And that was true in the first century. It continues to be true in the 21st century. The intensity of persecution, of course, has fluctuated and continues to fluctuate from time to time and place to place. So here in the UK, we are subject at the moment to nothing more painful than the kind of general mocking intimidation of the media, while brothers and sisters around the world are betrayed by a family member for converting from Islam and may even die. But Jesus is pretty realistic about it all. Verse 17, everyone will hate you because of me. Are you ready to be hated because of Jesus? Well, he expects loyalty to him in this context. Verse 19, stand firm and you will win life. That, I think, must be what he means by not a hair of your head will perish. He clearly can't mean you'll be utterly protected. He's just said you might die. But standing firm is the way you'll win life. Here's a guy from the second century called Justin Martyr. Guess what happened to him? Surname? Justin Martyr. Great Christian apologist, stood up arguing for the truth about Jesus. One guy he debated with, a philosopher guy, really hacked off, reported him to the Romans. At the time, if you didn't declare Caesar to be Lord, you might be put to death. Exactly what happened to him. Great phrase he came out with. You can kill us, but you can't do us any real harm. Isn't that excellent? I think he's taking Jesus' words very seriously here. And so here's a man prepared to stand up for Jesus. You see, this is a world against Jesus in a variety of ways, which means it'll be a world against us in a variety of ways. And living, waiting for the day that Jesus is seen to be king, means living, waiting, ready to stand up for him. You see, we're not called to die for him. You know, it's probably not going to happen. Who knows what will happen in this country? Possibility of fines for intolerance, or I say something in a sermon one day and get investigated. That sort of thing could have become more common. It's happened elsewhere in the world, in Western countries. Probably not going to be called to die for him just yet. But what does that attitude mean in living for him? You're prepared to die. That's pretty radical, isn't it? Challenge for us is how we stand up for him that radically in living for him. Okay, those are two things Jesus starts to say. Then come the signs of 70 AD. Verse 20. When you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you'll know its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those in the city get out. Let those in the country not enter the city. The command here is to flee Jerusalem rather than running to the city, or staying inside it, which would have been people's instincts. That's what you do. The army's coming. Get into the city. Right? Rather than running there, they're to get out because they are to escape the punishment that's coming. Verse 22. Why do you want to get out? For this is the time of punishment in fulfillment of all that has been written. And it will be dreadful. This is God's judgment on his people for their rejection. I believe We saw one of these predictions, prophecies of this, in our series back in Daniel, if you remember that. And it'll be an awful time. How dreadful it'll be if you're pregnant or nursing. There'll be great distress. People will fall by the sword, be taken prisoners to all the nations. Jerusalem will be trampled on by the Gentiles, all the nations. It's exactly what happened in the exile before, and God's judgment is falling again. This command to flee is clearly, I think, specific to 70 AD, and I think this judgment is clearly specific to that. And we know from records outside the Bible that Christians did indeed flee the city and get out. Now, up to verse 24, I think, is about the fall of Jerusalem. The question is what happens next. A lot of it turns on what you think, the end of verse 24, these times of the Gentiles are. You see the end of verse 24? It'll be until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Times of the nations is another, it's a perfectly good translation. And one quite strong argument is to say that Jesus here is basically talking about the end of the time of his people Israel, and now there'll be the times of the nations, where the gospel will go to all the nations and God's people will be spread among all the nations. And so he is picturing here a huge time period. And to say the times of the nations are fulfilled is to say, you know, up until the end. And verse 25 then jumps to what will happen when he comes at the end of time. Other people say, no, this is all still about 70 AD. Because what he goes on to are usually then taken to be signs of final judgment. See verse 25, the signs in the sun and the moon and the stars, the Son of Man coming in the cloud with great power, and so on. Now, as I've said, I've changed my mind this week already a couple of times. Basically, what I've been wondering about is whether verse 25 onwards is actually signs of final judgment, or if it's all about 70 AD. It might seem odd that I would say that, because, particularly, I suppose, verse 27, Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and glory, hang around Christian circles for very long, sing some Christian hymns, you know that is code for Jesus coming again. Yeah? That's what else could that be about? Well, let me just spend a moment on that, and then we'll come back to the flow, okay? So, that is a kind of an allusion or a quote of Daniel 7. Well, here's a bit of Daniel 7 on the screen. Good. In Daniel 7, Daniel has a vision, and he says, in his vision, I looked, and there was one before me like a Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days, that's God the Father, was led into his presence, and is given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an eternal dominion that will not pass away. His kingdom is one that is never to be destroyed. So the Son of Man is... Well, what's happening here? What is happening to this Son of Man in this passage? He's going to see God. He's travelling on the clouds. Where is he travelling to? Heaven. And what happens to him there? He's given authority. It doesn't use this phrase, but it's enthronement language. He goes to the Father, led into his presence. He's given authority and glory and sovereign power so that everyone will worship him. Now, there's a very good argument to say, because this is kind of the enthronement of the Son of Man, it's Jesus' enthronement rather than his return. Might this not be about some things that happen at the end of Jesus' life, in his resurrection and ascension, for example? And in fact, some of that coming on the clouds language, I think I can show you some references in the New Testament, where some of that language is used to refer to Jesus' enthronement in his ascension, not his second coming. I think it's used that way. But when is the final outworking of this? Jesus is enthroned such that he's given authority and sovereign power so that everyone will worship him. When will that actually happen? when he comes back. So you can argue as whether this passage could be applied to the end of Jesus' ministry and then the judgment that comes in 70 AD as God's vindication of his son, or the final moment at which everyone will see that he's been enthroned and see that God has exalted him. My point is simply that some of this language isn't as obvious as we tend to think it is. So, there are various questions here. As I've said, I've changed my mind already this week. And at the moment, I'm thinking this is actually about 70 AD, and then he moves to look at his final return, final judgment. That's my working position. But I can see arguments that you could say it's all about 70 AD. Even if you said it was, I still think the application to us is the same, because 70 AD is a picture of that final judgment. So let me stop there for one second, because there's lots more detail I could say. There's lots of verses I won't actually comment on now. I'm going to go on to some of the things he says at the end by way of application to us. But do you want to ask about some particular verses, or ask about how that is supposed to work? I've either confused you or made some sense or something. Chris?
When it says in verse 27, at that time...
Yeah.
So is that something of why you think it's the future judgment? Because the AD 70 is 40 years later, isn't it? It wouldn't say at that time, it would be in 40 years.
Well...
There's some Roman resurrection.
Yes, I'm completely convinced that the clouds language applies to the resurrection, ascension, enthronement. The question is whether 40 years later, at the judgment of Jerusalem, that is it were one of the first evidences of that, because God then judges people for their rejection of Jesus. And when it says at that time, well, it depends what you think the previous verses are about. But so far he's been talking about the fall of Jerusalem. And when it talks about, you know, signs in the sun and moon and so on, lots of Old Testament language talks that way. That's alluding to lots of Old Testament passages about kind of convulsions among nations. So Babylon falling or something is spoken about as a great sign in the heavens. But it's talking about a political thing happening. So if he's just talking about the tumult of stuff that's going to happen in 70 AD and then says, at that time. So you could argue that as 70 AD. Zach?
The parallel version of Mark, as at that time, people see something like a great power of glory, and it's going to take you forward.
Yeah.
Isn't that more obviously?
Yes. Yeah. There's a very similar passage in Mark 13 and Matthew 24. And I am convinced that in those passages, Jesus is talking about both 70 AD and then looking ahead to final judgment. One of the reasons I am is because he talks about a day that you can tell is coming. So he uses, like, verse 29, the fig tree. You can see it's coming. You know it's on its way. He talks about that. And then he also says, but about that day, no one can know. Day or the hour. So I think he's talking about two different days in those two passages. That's what makes sense of things like verse 32. I tell you the truth, this generation will not pass away until these things have happened. So in Matthew and in Mark, I'm more confident of what's happening. I don't know if Luke is doing the same thing or whether he's doing something slightly different. Well, it's clearly the same conversation, but because the 70 AD and the final judgment can have such similarities, I think you could have two angles on the same conversation. He could have just been picking out one stream of it. That, to be honest, that was the one thing that's pushed me back to thinking it is about both. So I think that's a good point, but I'm not sure if it's decisive. Matt? What does verse 35 mean? For it will come on all those who live on the face of the whole earth. What on earth does that mean if it was about 70 AD? It's a simple translation issue. When it says earth, it could easily be land. So, for example, in verse... I'll find it. is the time? Verse 23. There'll be great distress in the land. Same word. So it could refer to the land of Israel, the whole land of Israel, or it could refer to the whole earth. Any more on this? Yes.
What do you think Jesus' motivation or purpose is in leaving it unclear?
What is his motivation or purpose in leaving it unclear? Well, that's a really good question about any Bible passage we have difficulty understanding, isn't it? And we have to ask, did he actually mean to leave it unclear, or did he simply know that we would struggle? Because I take it he knew we'd be having this conversation today. But actually, he thinks it's clear enough. I'm not sure. Yeah, some of the time, that's a good point. He says, I wasn't understanding him some of the time. He went, yeah, well, you'll get it eventually. I think we should move on. I hope that's actually been an enlightening discussion rather than just a confusing one. I'm conscious it can get a little bit complicated. To summarise, I think he is talking about both judgment in 70 AD and the future. But even if it was all 70 AD, that's a picture of what will happen in the future. And his applications to us continue to apply. So let's press on with the applications. We've had two already. Here are two more. Be careful of distraction, verse 34. Be careful or your hearts will be weighed down. I'm not sure that's the best translation, more of a kind of a taken aside with dissipation, drunkenness and the anxieties of life, and that day will close on you suddenly like a trap. He's using a picture like an animal wandering into a trap because it's oblivious that it's there, so it just kind of wanders into it. And he's saying, similarly, it's possible for us to be caught out by this day coming, so distracted and caught up with other things that we just wander into it. Well, how could that happen? He says, your hearts could be weighed down, overtaken, distracted by other things. Well, what on earth could overtake my heart that I would be so oblivious to this day? Well, it could be weighed down with dissipation. Not a word we use very often. It just means kind of indulgence, giving ourselves to comfort and luxury, whatever takes our fancy, just enjoying the now. As an example, or closely related, I think, drunkenness. Drunkenness in the Bible does refer to drinking too much, but also refers to a kind of state of mind that is sort of oblivious to reality. It's got its literal and a metaphorical sort of use. You can see why, because you get drunk, you become intoxicated with something, and you just don't really know what's going on around you. We can give ourselves to the pleasures of life, then absorb us and intoxicate us, and we become blind to reality. We forget this world is heading towards a final day. We live for the now. Or the anxieties of life are what can weigh us down and overtake our hearts. The concerns of the things of this life, money, job, house, often perfectly good things, but things we can become absorbed in, that can dominate our thinking, and we can just forget this world is heading somewhere. Instead, we're just so focused on here, anxious about what I have to arrange and sort and do. I never look up and see what's coming. These things could distract us so that we wander into this day of judgment like a trap. And Jesus says, be careful. Which of those would you need to watch out for? Pleasure or anxiety? I think most of us probably fall into one of the two categories. So I'm a pleasure guy. You know, I'd happily give myself just to enjoying life. That's my temptation. Just enjoy the comfort, luxury, whatever. Just enjoy the now. Others I know, it's anxiety. You know, worry, what will I do? What will I do? Too much to organise. What are you? Which one might take your eye off the fact this world is going somewhere? That's got to be the question. Be careful, says Jesus. Lastly, quite similarly, keep looking ahead. Verse 36. Be always on the watch and pray that you may be able to escape all that's going to happen, that you may be able to stand before the Son of Man. Always on the lookout, ready, expectant. How? By praying. That prayer there isn't a second command. He says, be always on the watch, praying that. Praying is how you keep watch. You know judgment's coming. If you know judgment's coming, if you know Jesus will be exalted as Lord, if you know one day you'll have to stand before him, that will feature in your prayer life. And you'll pray that you may be kept safe through that and be able to stand before the Son. Now, we can. We can have confidence we can. If we keep trusting in Jesus. Jesus said, stand firm and you'll win life. But we must pray that we will stand firm. Do we pray about Jesus coming back? I'm not sure we do. If we don't, are we really keeping watch? Ready? Thinking it's coming, thinking it's a reality, that one day it'll be the last day. We've got a prayer evening next Sunday night. This will be on the menu, as it were, for us to pray about. God is going to exalt his Son, Jesus, and he will reign and his kingdom will come, and that will mean judgment on those who reject him. Do we live in the light of that day? Rather than more questions, to help us reflect and respond, we're going to sing a few songs, just a few in a row. Let's just have a, if the band wants to come up, we just have a moment's quiet. Just think to yourself what you want to take on board from what we've been thinking about this morning. What difference that day coming makes to you now for Jesus. So a moment's quiet, then over to the band.